Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Last week I talked about the various contexts and conditions under which samadhi arises, according to the early Buddhist texts. It will be surprising to many listeners that this quality of mind arises quite naturally as part of virtually any wholesome Buddhist practice, at least when it is engaged wholeheartedly, mindfully, and without distraction. This includes virtuous action, remembering the qualities of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, study of the Dharma, and of course, mindful observation of phenomena, what we know as satipatthana, or nowadays as vipassana, or insight meditation. The causal sequence, delight gives rise to tranquility, and tranquility gives rise to samadhi, is triggered in each of these contexts. One might say that these three qualities become the taste of Buddhist practice, a kind of aura ready at any point to glow in one, two, or three colors. The reason the ubiquity of this sequence and samadhi might surprise listeners is that the later Theravada tradition defines samadhi as something rare and difficult to achieve, something involving one-pointed absorption under ideal conditions and with specialized training in a meditation object. The early Buddhist texts describe something quite different. I also mentioned that right samadhi, the final path factor, is explicitly declared in the early Buddhist texts to be dependent on and therefore highly integrated with the cultivation of all of the other seven path factors. As a result, we cannot cultivate right samadhi without significant process in our practices of generosity, precepts, and attention to skillful states of mind, nor without right view. Virtue and wisdom are folded into the state of samadhi, just as delight, tranquility, and samadhi unfold from virtue and wisdom. There are right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right mindfulness. The unification of mind equipped with these seven factors is called noble right samadhi, with its supports and accessories. This may also be surprising to many listeners because of our strong tendency in Western Buddhism to treat meditation as an autonomous practice and to hope our ethics and wisdom will improve as an eventual consequence of meditation. Today, I want to shift gears and ask, what is the purpose of cultivating samadhi according to the early Buddhist texts? I think there are two answers. The first is pleasurable abiding, and the second is clarity and insight leading to knowledge and vision. The first, pleasurable abiding, is what I want specifically to take up today. The second is related to mindful observation or to satipatthana. Pleasurable abiding is a karmic fruit that we enjoy when we are engaged in wholesome practice of all kinds. It is also the least acknowledged of the two. Our practice, if we are doing it right, feels good, as delight gives rise to tranquility, and tranquility gives rise to samadhi. Samadhi may even progress through four levels called jhanas, literally meditations. The first, second, third, and fourth jhanas are four progressive stages of deeper samadhi. Clarity and insight are commonly associated with meditation practice on the cushion, aimed at developing wisdom and eventually liberation. They depend on right view and on the whole range of jhanas. Although this sounds like the really good stuff, we'll put them aside for this talk. So let's look at the also important pleasurable abiding. The Buddha-to-be, that is the Bodhisatta, before his awakening, after years of severe ascetic practice, which seems to have been based on the principle, no pain, no gain, recalled a childhood incident in which he had entered spontaneously into a meditative state, a jhana. The Bodhisatta considers this remembered incident to be of pivotal significance in finding the middle way. As he recounted, I recall once when my father, the Sakyan, was working, and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree. Then, quite withdrawn from sensuality, withdrawn from unskillful mental qualities, I entered and remained in the first jhana, delight and pleasure born from withdrawal, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. Could that be the path to awakening? Then, following on that memory, came the realization, that is the path to awakening. I thought, so why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensuality, nothing to do with unskillful mental qualities? I thought, I am no longer afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensuality, nothing to do with unskillful mental qualities. But it's not easy to achieve that pleasure with a body so extremely emaciated. Suppose I were to take some solid food, some rice and porridge. So I took some solid food, some rice and porridge. The Buddha had discovered a crack in his understanding of spiritual practice that he would pry open to gain access to the middle way. The crack was the difference previously unnoticed between worldly, lokiya, pleasure, and supramundane, lokuttara, pleasure. Likewise, fear and pleasure would no longer be the primary consideration in his dietary habits, but rather keeping the body healthy in order to sustain his practice. We all know from Keanu Reeves what happened next. His five companions in No Pain, No Gain saw things differently, and thinking Gotama had fallen into luxury, abandoned him in a huff, leaving him to discover the path to awakening on his own. Here is where we get to an important function of samadhi, that of driving a wedge between worldly and supramundane pleasure. Settling into progressive Buddhist practice has ever since been in close alignment with displacing the worldly with the supramundane. Here is how the Buddha describes this point. Before my enlightenment, while I was still an unenlightened bodhisatta, I too clearly saw, as it actually is with proper wisdom, how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, and much despair, and how great is the danger in them. But as long as I still did not attain to the delight and pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that, I recognized that I still could be attracted to sensual pleasures. But when I clearly saw, as it actually is with proper wisdom, how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, and much despair, and how great is the danger in them. I attain to the delight and pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that. I recognize that I was no longer attracted to sensual pleasures. Delight and pleasure here are, of course, the precursors for something more peaceful than that, namely tranquility and samadhi. I have to admit that some years ago I was confused by the role of supramundane pleasure in Buddhist practice on three counts. First, it seemed at the time that when the Buddha spoke of supramundane pleasure, it was in the context of jhana, which put me in the context of meditation on the cushion. But on the other hand, I noticed that non-sensual pleasure also arises from virtuous actions. Helping others feels good, and with mindfulness and without distraction, it feels really good. And this kind of pleasure seems to have nothing to do with sensuality. Can't this also be classified as supramundane even without sitting on the cushion? The second thing that confused me is that the Buddha talked about delight and tranquility as necessary precursors to samadhi, and delight is supposed to be retained as a factor in the first two jhanas. This, for instance, is in the teaching of the seven factors of awakening, in which mindfulness gives rise to investigation. Investigation gives rise to energy. Energy gives rise to delight. Delight gives rise to tranquility. Tranquility gives rise to samadhi. And samadhi gives rise to equanimity. But sometimes my meditations seem perfectly deep and tranquil, yet seem to have skipped right over delight and pleasure. The third thing that confused me, I did not initially attribute to the difference between mundane and supramundane pleasures. This was that monastics tend not to be so excited by, or obsessed with, or dedicated to formal meditation as much as many devoted lay people. In fact, I noticed this in myself as I transitioned from devoted layperson to devoted monk. All three puzzles became clear as I discovered, both in the early Buddhist texts and in my own experience, that samadhi is not locked away in an autonomous, single-minded practice of meditation, but is in fact ubiquitously about to emerge, if not actually present, in devout Buddhist practice, and is moreover highly integrated with wisdom or right view and with virtue. When I looked closer, I began to discover, in fact, the rarely cited texts that reveal samadhi in unexpected contexts, contexts we talked about last week. At the same time, I realized that I was often in my own meditation reaching for samadhi too single-mindedly and one-pointedly, rather than letting it flow with delight from wisdom, virtue, and refuge. I was thereby practicing samadhi, but not right samadhi. Finally, I recognize that the very unique privilege monastics enjoy to practice 24/7 means that the glow of delight, tranquility, and samadhi is always readily at hand if one just leans into it. In contrast, most lay people live complex lives and as a result thrash abruptly back and forth between practice life and worldly life. That had certainly been my experience. And that worldly life is so harsh, busy, and competitive that the cushion becomes a kind of lifeline to sanity in their lives. The great American Buddhist monk Tenisaro Bhikkhu gave a talk in which he described an implication of the common, narrow view of meditation or samadhi that I am trying to disabuse listeners of. in Tenisaro Bhikkhu's words. Several years ago, when Ajahn Suwat was teaching a retreat at IMS, I was his interpreter. After the second or third day of the retreat, he turned to me and said, "I notice that when these people meditate, they're awfully grim. You'd look out across the room and all the people were sitting there very seriously, their faces tense, their eyes closed tight. It was almost as if they had nirvana or bust written across their foreheads." He attributed their grimness to the fact that most people here in the West come to Buddhist meditation without any preparation in other Buddhist teachings. They haven't had any experience in being generous in line with the Buddhist teachings on giving. They haven't had any experience in developing virtue in line with the Buddhist precepts. They come to Buddhist teachings without having tested them in daily life, so they don't have the sense of confidence they need to get them through the hard parts of the meditation. They feel they have come to rely on sheer determination instead. Meditation is a powerful practice in most contexts. I began myself with the yogic practice of absorption in the breath. 40 years ago, with no thought of virtue, right view, or refuge, and was quite thrilled with the novelty of the experience and with attaining some degree of control over my mind. However, although I achieved some very still states, what I was experiencing was far removed from right samadhi in the Buddhist context, which must integrate virtue and right view along with mindfulness and non-distraction. We need a foundation and walls before we can build the roof. It's fortunate that in developing wisdom and virtue, delight, tranquility, and samadhi come so readily to hand and thereby flood all of our practice with supramundane pleasure. Meditation can extend this experience into the higher jhanas and lead to knowledge and vision, which culminate in liberation.